welcome to the Green Tea Energy Podcast by the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Study. My name is Leonie Higita. Today I'm joining with my co-host
Amethyst Devlin
and Shaida Hushmandi.
We had a break our podcast last month, and because we are in the very busy for writing 1 million page of podcast reports. Sorry about that. And the end of May, we are finally are able to graduate.
Yay!
So we are now Master of Sustainable Energy.
That's us.
Yes. We appreciate all your support for this accomplishment. So for the next few episodes, each podcast host will present our topics of Capstone's project. And today's presenter is Amethyst. Her Capstone project is Building Electrification and Just Transitions. Amethyst, tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I feel like I projected this episode on our very first episode when we talked about what we do for a living, and I talked about how I work in commercial real estate and buildings, and I love it, and I'm super passionate about it, and I could talk about it forever, and now I get my own episode to talk about it, so I'm very excited. So for my capstone, I decided to do a policy analysis for a bill that's only recently been introduced into the council here in DC, that kind of just is the next step for DC as they start to look at how we electrify buildings and how we do that in a just way where low-income communities and other marginalized communities can participate in the transition with very few barriers in place. And so DC has adopted recently this act that says that they need to establish building electrification codes for new buildings as they come on, and that comes into effect at the end of 26. And then they have to really start to understand what that means for the rest of the grid. What does it look like for a very highly dominant gas infrastructure city with a very old infrastructure? The median age of the built environment here is 75 years. We have a lot of really, really old infrastructure here that has antiquated energy systems. What does it mean for those buildings, whether they be commercial buildings, residential buildings, multifamily buildings of any type, to also transition? Because we don't want to leave those assets consuming natural gas, especially when there's been plenty of reports published from the district saying that there are methane leaks. The Washington Gas and Lighting, who's the gas provider here in the district, has a accelerated pipe replacement program to go through and replace these pipes to mitigate the gas and methane leaks within the city, which highly impact residential sectors. And so really trying to understand how we get the next step, right? Like, how do we get a low-income household to be able to afford a electrification transition in their home? And that's not necessarily just by subsidies. We can't just give them a $300 off coupon and expect that that's going to be enough, especially if you look at a home that's like in the dead of winter and their water heater goes out and it's a natural gas water heater and they need to replace it. And their hierarchy of needs says that they need warm water inside of their home for their children, for themselves. And the easiest pathway, regardless of a $300 coupon off, is replacing it with a natural gas infrastructure. And if we have residents who cannot replace that with electrification, then the district just gets a step in step behind those climate goals as we approach them.
So I know that this topic is close to your heart because I think from the first days that we started the program together, you were very passionate about how to get marginalized communities involved in the transition. Just explain to us, why is it important to have them on board for transitioning to a greener future?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the very early things that I learned as a researcher in this space is that I didn't feel like there was enough people speaking up about these important topics. It's really hard to speak on, not necessarily on behalf of another community, but like speak for their experience until they are empowered or enabled to come to the table and speak for themselves. And I think that that's one of the things that I always try to do with my research is that I never want to put words in somebody else's mouth. I never want to speak for somebody else. I come from a very, very low income background, and I can see the world through that perception, and I have my own intersections of marginalization that are influenced by policy. And so I think that it's really important that I'm a very loud person. I'm willing to stand up and scream at the top of my lungs in order to make sure that there's space for somebody else. And the moment I get that space for them, then I recede. And I want their voices and their stories to be the ones that are elevated. But I think often if you look at panels or if you look at other conversations happening in this space, you'll notice a lot of very similar trends, and it's a lot of people who look the same who are leading the conversation. And it's if they don't constantly every single day bring the understanding with them that they have to work on this with a just transition lens or an equity lens, or understand that there are other people who walk different paths, then like that shows up in policy. And it doesn't show up until the policy has been passed and then the data is being measured 5 years later and they're like, wow, this isn't the impact that we meant to have. We really wanted to reach this community, but we didn't reach that community because we didn't engage them at the beginning. And so like by doing this policy analysis as soon as this bill was announced and really, I mean, it's just been referred to subcommittees at this point. There's no like even indication that this is necessarily going to pass, but I wanted to ensure that like I was using my my platform and my time in this moment to use my capstone to ensure that those voices were being heard at the infancy of the bill and were being considered as well.
I mean, thanks to you and whoever was loud about this issue. I think back in the day, environmental justice was just at the footnote. Now it's on the headlines, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. So going back to the topic of your research, what are the key provisions of the Building Electrification Bill enacted by the DC Council, and what do you think the implications of such bill can be?
Yeah, so there's the act that passed, and that one has like really great, it just has such a good platform to be able to make new commercial buildings really transition. And those, I mean, if you look at DC, for example, in general, the built environment plays a huge role in greenhouse gas emissions. You're looking at 40% of greenhouse gas emissions coming from our buildings. When you get into urban populations like DC, that very quickly becomes 75% of our greenhouse gas emissions. And so then the biggest electricity users, which are these large commercial buildings, being able to right at the beginning say, okay, well, if you build a new one, it has to be electrified because we can make those electrons carbon-free later down the road. We cannot make your natural gas carbon-free down the road. And so being able to do that is great. That's its own like big hurrah. But then on the other side, most of the buildings that we are going to use in 40 to 50 years already exist. And they were built with natural gas, and they were built with infrastructure that doesn't necessarily support electrification easily. And so that's really where I wanted to kind of pivot, especially as you look at the residential sector, what those implications are if your biggest electricity users or your biggest natural gas users transition, but the subsidy that is put on by Washington Gas and Lighting is to maintain the infrastructure is based on how much natural gas is used, then suddenly those like that subsidy gets pushed really heavily onto your old building stock. It gets pushed onto your residents. who have a reliance on natural gas and already are facing possibly any type of energy insecurity and other barriers that impact them financially and impact their households. And now they're also carrying this magnified burden of replacing the infrastructure of natural gas when your large commercial buildings are going electric. And so I really just wanted to zone in on that, and then specifically a bill that was proposed to provide household electrification retrofits to 30,000 low-income households inside of the district. And then additionally, the bill calls for basically a sliding scale participation for moderate income households to be able to provide them with electrification retrofits as well. And one of the big, like, key elements that I focused on was what the definition was in this bill of what a household electrification retrofit was. And the definition called out the replacement of an appliance, like a stove or a heating system or a water heater of some type that is using natural gas right now with an appliance that would use electricity. And one of the big key oversights that I believe comes through this bill is that you don't take into consideration the age of infrastructure in the district and how these homes that have a natural gas reliance also don't necessarily have an electric system to easily be able to replace an appliance for an appliance. And I feel this as a DC homeowner myself.
I was gonna say, because you went through this.
Yeah, and it's very important to me. I did not grow up with natural gas in my home. I'm so uncomfortable with a natural gas stove being in my home. It scares me. I mean, I have animals. They will click the knobs. I have little safety locks on the knobs because of one of my dogs. And I I'm not comfortable with it being in my home, but also I work in decarbonization of buildings and I want to be able to claim net zero, and I still have a few appliances in my home, like my stove, my water heater, which is from the 90s and is going to go any day now, and my natural gas dryer, my clothing dryer. I didn't even know that they made those, but they do. And when I moved in, bought my house, I got solar and I put solar on my house, but I still need to electrify in order to actually be able to use all of that. And one of the big elements is my electric panel is way too small. My lights flicker. If I run the microwave, the dining lights get really, really bright and dim and flicker. And it was flagged as soon as I bought my house. But what I didn't realize is that this was going to be a $15,000 piece of construction, because my 1940s house has an electric panel and an electric meter. Mostly the meter is the problem, that's down inside my basement. And by current building codes, that meter needs to be outside in front of my front porch. It requires me to pay a contractor to come in and trench a whole new electric line, a whole new service line inside of my house. And in order to electrify and get these solar panels going, I have to have $15,000 to pay. And I'm lucky and privileged that I have that ability. Not saying it wasn't stressful to pull that together, but if it was the difference between me being able to feed my family or not, I'm never going to choose that. And nor would I blame anybody for not choosing to electrify when that means that's multiple months of a mortgage payment.
Absolutely.
You know, we can't hold those standards. And I think for so long, these climate conversations are so earnestly directed towards individual consumer actions, that this is just another way that we're pushing it on the consumer and blaming them if it doesn't happen.
Yeah, so your capital project is very interesting, because it's not only, so this policy is in the political perspective is reducing use of fossil fuel, but our perspective as a normal general people, it's very important for the public health. And it's a very your literature review mentioned so there's a relations between a child food asthma and natural gas exposure. That is a big takeaway to me, and it's a very important switching our electricity from fossil fuel.
And yeah, it's very interesting. Also, the gas infrastructure is closely related to income demographics. Yeah. That is, yeah, I didn't know at all, but your findings and research and mentioned that, and it was very interesting. Do you want to talk about that more?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of interesting because if you look nationally at our trends, the demographic of like high income is actually usually more related to higher natural gas use inside of the home. But there's been a few studies that have come out in the mid-Atlantic, like looking in this region and how our infrastructure has been influenced by like weather trends and the older infrastructure as it exists, that we see a higher prevalence of natural gas just generally. But then when we look at the income demographics in this region, we actually see that like a lower income demographic equates to more natural gas, and even using it in situations like using your natural gas stove to heat your home in the winter because it's more reliant than your old like heater. So a big part of the literature review then is I was trying to tie all of these pieces together to make an argument for a very simplified model that I made that essentially said that by excluding electric panel upgrades called heavy ups for homes within this bill, you are looking at a huge gap of somebody who can accept all of your free incentives to replace all of their appliances, but if they can't afford to also do a heavy up electrification in their home, then they're not going to accept any of them, right? It's just like it's more barriers in front of them and they would have to overcome that. And very interesting with the timing of this research is that at the beginning of this year, natural gas stoves became a very big conversation for so many people. I started this research last year and I was telling people all about it, and I was getting text messages being like, I never heard anything about a natural gas stove, and now it's all over my news that like they want to take natural gas stoves away. And one of the findings that inside of my literature review is that these public health implications of having natural gas stoves and cooking with natural gas in your homes, none of these findings are new. We've known for a very long time that they have public health impacts. There's more refined research coming out that like the most recent study that was in that review that says it's like somewhere near 12.6% of childhood asthma cases are related to having natural gas stoves inside of the home. But those findings aren't new. What's really coming out that's new is the public health policy recommendations. So originally the recommendations were like, use better fume hoods. And now they're like, sure, use proper fume hoods, but also like maybe step one is just getting rid of natural gas inside of the residential setting in the first place. That part is new, and that's a very large cultural shift for us, is that we're willing to like break free of our natural gas, but it has become such a hot topic in a way that it has been politicized like beyond belief. Well, the fact that there's merch that exists that says like, don't tread on my natural gas stove or whatever, you know, like, I mean, I went down some rabbit holes for this research, but I was just like shocked by the fact that it's not that it's new. It's not that people disagree with the findings, but like people are very dead set on keeping their natural gas stoves.
And as you mentioned, a lot of people are willing to change their gas stoves for the electric version, but really cannot afford to do that. And that's sort of connected to the redlining policy that was also mentioned in your research extensively. Just to explain to our audience, redlining wasn't, probably for people who don't live in the US, it was an unfair practice by the government in the past. After the Great Depression, they drew lines around black and immigrant neighborhoods to mark them as risky for getting mortgages. The neighborhoods were given ratings as dangerous or good, and dangerous ones were marked as red. And most of these neighborhoods were near industrial sites with loads of toxin and pollution in the air, water and soil. And to this date, the redlining's legacy exists, and it does even impact even like the smallest policies that we want to have in, let's say, in District of Columbia. We would be facing a similar situation as we would have in the past, right? And that's relevant to the redlining policy that was enacted years and decades ago.
I think that the main takeaway that I really wanted to make in that part of my research was that So the Federal Housing Administration is actually the one who put together the redlining map for the District of Columbia. And they used that map to argue for, like, the most discriminatory policies. I mean, they basically put this map out and then they said, like, there's a shortage of housing for white folks in the district. And because of this, we are recommending that if you're a multifamily site and you open your house to non-white citizens, or your building to non-white citizens, that you should charge a 10% rent increase. And they did this because they really wanted to be able to back up, like, these segregation laws that they had put in that said, like, only, you know, white people can live in these buildings and such. And when we look at something that's like that, you know, I put these two maps together for DC in particular, where it was like looking at racial house covenants and also the redlining and how that impacted the racial demographics inside of the district in 1970, that map. I mean, that was 30 years after this redlining map was published. And, or 40 years, excuse me. And then I put together a map that was like the 2020 census demographics. And not a whole lot has changed. If you look at the demographics of where your low-income citizens live, if you look at the demographics of where your non-white citizens live, these maps have eerily similar overlay, and they are 50 years apart. But this is what we mean when we talk about, like, systemic disadvantage and how marginalized communities have been set up for failure. If your family who immigrated here couldn't purchase a home, then you are right off the bat put at a disadvantage because you can't build generational wealth. And you can't build generational wealth in a place that is safe and free from industrial pollution for your family, you know. And it also influenced how the administrations decided to inject money into communities, what they decided was a community that was worthy of a community like center development and what wasn't. And I mean, when you look at, okay, now we're distributing, or we're looking at a new bill that's going to put out a ton of funding that is very vital to these communities, to 30,000 low-income households, you have to be mindful of where that money actually goes first. Because it, in my personal point of view, that money cannot go into communities that have historically been at an advantage from these systemic considerations. You have to be able to back up and say, okay, what are we still facing? What are the downpipe considerations from bills that passed 80 years ago? Because they're there and they are lurking in all of your cities. It's not just a DC thing, that exists in all of these cities. And they heavily impact how money is put into communities, what health implications those communities face, what their life expectancy is in the same city, how different it can be based on what resources are available from a policy 80 years ago. You know, like, that was really what I was trying to draw, is that, like, as they roll out this funding, they have to be mindful of where it goes in order to use the funding and leverage it in the best way possible to mitigate the impacts that we're still facing from discriminatory housing policy. I also, this is one of those moments that I definitely want to put a different voice into the lens who has a different perspective and has a lot more expertise in this area of research. And that researcher, his name is Andre Perry, and he has done a lot of really great research, but especially in housing inequality and looking at the implications of these the impacts that we feel from redlining. And in particular, there's if any of our listeners are really interested in looking at another researcher's work, in 2018, they put out a paper called The Devaluation of Assets in Black Neighborhoods. And it looks at how doing property value assessments and evaluations inside of these neighborhoods, these houses, they've often been discriminated against and had like lower tax benefits and lower home values. And then if you're comparing like for like, you're just passing on this like generational inequality instead of like constantly transforming your systems in a way that mitigates those impacts and changes them. So I would definitely recommend, if anybody's interested, that is a great researcher to follow up on Andre Perry.
So I guess I want to ask, what is your elevator pitch? How would you describe your findings in like three sentences?
Hey, I'm a citizen in DC. I study sustainable energy, and I've done this policy analysis for you. I think that there are a lot of opportunities for you to ensure that this drives an equitable transition and make sure that this bill aligns with the district's overall climate goals. I'd love to sit down and talk with you about it sometime.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, I
have too much confidence.
That's great.
You deserve it. So yeah, I read your conclusion too, but and you, I think one of the recommendations you wrote is a stakeholder engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And in your perspective, what kind of stakeholders should be involved in this discussion?
I think this is like a really hard question, because if you're looking at the communities, the low-income communities who are already facing like a financial burden, they're not necessarily going to be able to participate in this just during work hours, right? Like they're not going to be able to come to all of your council meetings and discuss these really important topics, nor they may not understand the actual impact of this, right? Like this electrification code has just passed and they have no idea what that means. All they know is that they have to pay their electricity bill every single month and they have to pay their gas bill every month. And they're so focused on getting that done that they can't focus on anything else, rightfully so. And so I think that this comes into the point that's been made by many people, not me, but many, many people, is that stakeholders have to be paid for their time. They have to be involved in a way that, again, reduces the barriers for participation, because otherwise, if you look at like who's showing up to your city council meetings, it's not the people who are working three jobs to keep a roof over their head. They don't have time to show up for that. They can have time to show up for that if they can also drop one of those jobs and be an active member in their community, as much as they're worried about putting a roof over their head. And so that is like the next layer of this participation, where this has to be distributed in an equitable way. People can participate for free. You also need to pay people to participate. You need to pay certain people and certain voices to be participating and active, and especially in the wards. In DC, we use wards as a way to describe our neighborhoods, but in those wards that are going to be the most impacted by this policy, who are going to see the electrification retrofits, who have been most systemically put at a disadvantage, they have to be paid for their, they deserve to be paid for their participation, and we need to learn from those outlooks and those perspectives as much as we can.
So yeah, very interesting research. So but what comes next for your research?
I think next for my research, I mean, it's hard. I want to make all these grand promises, but also I just graduated and I'm playing a lot of video games right now. So maybe like give me a couple months and I'll get up off of my couch. but I would say that like I really found so much passion and purpose writing this. There were so many times that I was writing this paper, and it was different than any other research I've ever written, where I just looked over at my wife and said, like, I'm so excited. Like, I feel like I have so much to add to this conversation. And that doesn't end with me submitting a capstone, right? This bill is still in its infancy. There's a lot of things it's going to have to do. Hopefully there's a lot of opportunities for me to go and talk to folks and try to influence change, and then continue to do this type of policy research, because this is my niche. This is what I love doing. And I feel like this is something I can give to my community, is constantly ensuring that these voices are being heard. And that's what I'm going to keep doing.
Great research and fantastic conversation. Thank you, Amethyst. So this is a wrap from us. Thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you found the discussion enlightening and interesting. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and stay tuned for future episodes where we continue to explore engaging topics. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter. Just search for our name, Hopkins Green Tea. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.